and welcome to season 22 of the Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership podcast. I am your host, Ruth Haley Barton, and we are talking with Dr. Kurt Thompson about his new book, The Deepest Place, Suffering and the Formation of Hope. And we've already been having some very deep conversations. This is, in this episode, we're looking forward to talking about the idea of endurance and perseverance. We're working with Romans 5, verses 1 through 5, as sort of the foundational biblical passage that we're interacting with. And there are some really amazing things stated there about the actual process of seeing durable hope formed in us. So welcome back, Kurt. It's good to be with you again.
Ruth, always a pleasure. And as I said the last time, I pinch myself every time I get to think about we just keep getting to do this.
We just keep getting to talk. Yes, this is like a dream come true for me as well, because, you know, so maybe you have to have a podcast to just get to talk to your closest friends deeply about good topics, right? Yeah. Maybe this is the whole reason I do this. Yeah. It's just so I get to talk to the people I want to talk to. and I definitely am enjoying talking to you. So as we enter into this episode, I want to talk about perseverance, the bridge between suffering and hope, because that's the way you name it, as sort of the bridge between suffering and hope. There's two biblical translations for this particular word. In the NIV, there's the word, is it perseverance in the NIV, and then endurance in the New Revised Standard. Both of those words seem to have a nuance. So why don't you talk about the nuance that you hear in those two words, and also how these dynamics play a part in the formation of hope?
Yeah, I think in English, there are elements of both of those words that are crucially important.
Yeah.
There is a certain sense, at least the connotation of how I use and think about the word persevering has this sense in which there is movement involved. I am going to continue to move in the face of something that is resistant to me. I'm going to continue to move. So there's a connotation of movement. Endurance, for me, It brings the connotation of a capacity to weather things. I'm not necessarily having to move, but I am having to weather something that is coming out. So I'm not just moving, but I am having to be present to and with and not retreating in the face of something that is continually difficult for me. In this case, the suffering that we're talking about. I'm not withering. I'm not imploding. I'm enduring this. And so for me, there is a blending of both of these words that I think, you know, adding all the elements of both of those words, if we could come up with a word that would kind of capture both of them, that's kind of how I think about
it. Yeah, that's good. And that's why at the beginning of this season, I wanted us to both read the passage in both of the translations, because there are some slight nuances depending on the translation that you read. And what that does for me, it just gives it color. It gives it fullness to hear all the translations and what's contained within those.
Right.
So, you know, the biblical passage of Romans 5 talks about the fact that we boast in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance or perseverance, and endurance or perseverance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope that does not disappoint. So there's a process here that seems to be being described in Scripture. So how does endurance or perseverance fit into this process of having a durable hope formed in us?
Yeah, well, I mean, without him, you know, having a training background in psychiatry,
did Paul do a pretty good job?
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the things that we talk about with our patients is that we do not make change. Human beings do not make changes until or unless they have suffered enough. Now, I don't mean that they've suffered, but that they've suffered enough. There are plenty of people who suffer who do not choose to make changes.
Yes.
Okay. And one of the things then that Paul is basically, you know, just saying plainly, when we suffer, we are exposed to a choice. I can choose to move through this. I can choose to persevere through this. Or I can withdraw. I can implode. And what he's saying is that in order for us to move to hope, it requires us to enter into those qualities of that combination of perseverance and endurance that we were talking about just a moment ago, that we necessarily have to be committed to putting the next step in front of the next step.
Yeah.
We have to be committed to not throwing in the towel. This is not easy to do. This is perseverance is really hard to do. But what's most important, it's easy for us to say, oh, just persevere. And we can know that's a good thing, but it's a really hard thing.
Yeah.
But what we understand in human behavior that is significant about perseverance is not necessarily even the degree of difficulty of the task at hand. It has a lot to do with a couple of features. One, A, do I have a sense that what I'm doing is leading to something beyond it? Do I have a sense that this is going someplace? And the other is someone with me doing this who is able to acknowledge that what I am doing, what we are doing, is hard to do. This is really hard to do. One of the most, you know, powerful pieces of research that I've come across in a long time, 20 years ago, Carol Dweck, that you may be familiar with in her work around mindset and this notion of how when people acknowledge that what other people are doing is hard to do, it enables them to continue to do the hard thing. This acknowledgement that actually gives the person who's doing the hard work the felt sense that they are seen in their hard work.
Yes.
That they are not alone in their hard work. Again, getting back to our previous conversation about atonement, that atonement is as much about God coming fully to be with me. Mm-hmm. This is, I am with you, not like the chair is with you in the room. I am with you to help you. I am with you to encourage you. I am with you to say, yep, this is really hard to do. Let's keep doing this together. And so if I am practicing in this way, from a neurobiological standpoint, this is really crucially important because it leads right into a conversation about neuroplasticity and the role that that plays in creating durability of any kind of behavior, including all of our mental activities, including our experience and expression of hope.
Yeah. You know, as you were speaking, I got this picture in my mind of the experience that our family had in I've got two brothers, and you know one of them, but my other brother is also a pastor, and he competes in Ironman competitions. And he was quite overweight when he began to take on being in these competitions and training for them, and wanted to experience life in his body as a good gift. And so he's got a very competitive streak in him. And so competing in an Ironman and training with others and being known as something other than a pastor, you know, it was really good for him to be in a training group where he was just training with other people who didn't even know him to be a pastor. But the first Ironman competition, our whole family went. And it's sad to say that most of us said we haven't seen that kind of support of human beings for each other quite like that. And it's not like that in the church at all. You know, the kind of support that the athletes were getting in that environment was very, very different than what we even experience in church. But what I saw when you were talking was the fact that we, as his family, we were the ones that knew what his journey had been. And we were the ones who knew he was training. We saw him dropping that weight. And we knew how hard this was for him. We knew what a reversal this was for him in terms of how he had been living in his body. And so an Ironman competition is hard on the spectators as well, because you literally run from one place to another to try to get a glimpse of your athlete. And then you're the ones there. And I could even get teary right now. We would be standing there and he would come by us and we would cheer for him and then we would cry, because we knew how significant this was for his journey. We knew the hard work. We knew the hard work that the event itself was. And that was our job. It was our job to run from place to place to try to get a glimpse of him and to let him have a glimpse of us cheering him on. It was profound. And so I feel like that's what you're saying. We were the group of people who knew that it was hard.
Right.
Who
right.
knew that what right. he had done and was doing was hard.
Right.
And all the reasons why it was hard. And we were there to say, we know this is hard. And the other thing I was aware of was we couldn't do the work for him. We couldn't run that race for him. He had to run it, but we could be there saying, we see you. We see how hard you've worked, how hard this is. And I know, and he said that every time he would see us, he would get renewed energy. to keep running his race.
Yeah.
So that's what I saw as a picture of what you were just describing. People who know how hard this is and who are there cheering us on.
Yeah, such a beautiful example. You know, one of the things that we that happens in the psychiatric consultation room invariably is you begin to see a patient and very soon they will say, well, how will I know when I'm done?
Mm.
How will I know when I no longer have to come back to see you? What are the benchmarks that let me know this? And I say, you will know that you are getting close to being done when you've come to the place where you love doing the work. Mm. And like, wait a minute. If I start to love doing the work, why would I stop doing the work? Mm. To which we say, right, this actually reveals the nature of what's going on that prompts you to ask the question in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Because we think that life is about acquiring benchmarks. I want to get to the goal. The goal is it.
To be done.
Right. And what we're saying is benchmarks are not unimportant. Having a goal is not unimportant. But we all know that as soon as we achieve it, we're now looking to the next thing. It's not durable. A benchmark is not durable. What is durable is my willingness to enjoy doing the work. And so for my patients, they will come to places where they actually have met behavioral benchmarks.
Mm-hmm.
They've met cognitive benchmarks. And what I try to do with them is to say, I'm really glad for you that you've gotten to this point, but I'm even more proud of you for all of the hard work that it has taken.
Yeah.
When Tom Brady wins another Super Bowl, although he won't be doing that now, but when he has in the past won a Super Bowl, in the post-game interviews, nobody asks him questions about training camp.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody asks him about the work of that one out route where you threw it 40 times every day of the week mm-hmm. until we got it absolutely perfect mm-hmm. the last 10 times. Nobody's going to ask that question. It's not sexy. It's not exciting. But that is where the game is won.
Mm-hmm.
People used to say Michael Jordan didn't beat people on game day. Michael Jordan beat people on the practice court.
Yeah.
Because there were plenty of people who were just as talented as Michael Jordan was when he played. But nobody worked harder than he did during practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so acknowledging for folks that the work is hard and that we are proud of how hard they are working, not just have you reached the mm-hmm. benchmark, is critical in letting them know that somebody sees that this is actually hard. Mm-hmm. Life is difficult.
Yeah.
And for me to persevere in the presence of others who are acknowledging that makes all the difference in the durability of the hope that I'm eventually able to create.
Yeah. So then apply that more specifically then to the formation of hope. How do we know that we are making progress through perseverance towards a durable hope? What I know that the benchmarks, it's not trying to get there so that you can stop. But what mm-hmm. are some of those markers that tell us I am making progress in the formation of durable hope?
Practically speaking, I mean, one of the things that we like to talk about is that, again, we've said, or I think, you know, in an earlier episode, we talked briefly about how hope is the mind's imagination of the future. I'm imagining something out in the future that is mm-hmm. hopeful, whether that's 5 minutes from now or 5 years from now. But my future is always something that I am making up out of my past experience. And so we like to talk about how we remember our future. If my past that I remember is one that is fraught with anxiety, one that is fraught with regret, one that I am thinking about or imagining as one of sadness and all of those ways of imagining my life and my story, that necessarily will be the future that I imagine. Mm-hmm. That's not a very hopeful one. But what if someone who is a spiritual directee for you, a pastor who comes to you for counsel, and you sit with their grief, with their suffering, and you don't give them answers. Instead, you give them you. You give them your mm-hmm. presence. And they sense that, and they feel that. And they sense and feel your non-anxious presence that is one of loving kindness, in the, while they are experiencing their distress, that is actually giving their brain a very different experience of their distress. Just like I was having sitting at the table with you in 2017. I'm having a different experience of my story in my distress while I'm sitting with you, not because you give me answers to questions, not because you fix my problem, but because you are present and attuned to me with loving kindness. It's not about you logically, linearly talking to the part of my brain that needs that kind of logic. It's the part of you that is with me that I need, that really is the place where my suffering is being shaped. The felt sense of myself while I'm with myself. But when I'm with you and you're with that suffering, something about the suffering changes.
Yes.
Okay. What happens if I'm your directee and I come back to you a month later and a month later, or 2 weeks later and 2 weeks later? I'm practicing having this same experience over and over and over again. And the neural networks that were not even present before the first time we talked, that begin to fire and then create and then become more durable in their firing pattern, take on a greater durability, which means that more and more I am beginning to imagine my suffering in a context of loving kindness. Which means I can imagine a future wherein which, if I'm still suffering a week from now, I'm less worried because Ruth is with me, even if you're not in the room. And this changes the very nature of what my brain is doing. And this changes the nature. This is how practice, perseverance, this is how in its firing, taking advantage of how the brain's neuroplastic changes happen, it helps me form new neural networks that help me anticipate a future that is now grounded in a remembered past in which when I suffer, someone is with me, which is a very different element, because most of our suffering, as we've said so far, most of what is most painful about our suffering has to do with the fact that we experience it in isolation. The things I am feeling, I am alone with it. I don't picture Ruth or John or Jesus being with me in the room, right? And to the degree that Ruth can be with me, it primes neural networks in my brain to imagine that the Jesus that I read about in the Gospels can be with me.
So you're actually talking about mediation a little bit, right? That it's almost like we as human beings are able to mediate the presence of Christ to each other in moments like this. And in fact, maybe even to go a little further, that it's the priesthood of all believers right there.
That, totally.
Yeah, that we're able to mediate this presence of the unseen God or the unseen Jesus to one another through our own flesh,
right,
through our own physical presense.
Right. And I think that this is, we talked earlier about how we read so much in the scriptures, we hear so much from pulpits that is so familiar to us, it just goes right by us. And we also like, I don't know what that means. Yes, whatever that means. This is an example of how God's material world and the way that it works, and talking about neuroplasticity, for example, helps us recognize that the things that, when God says, remember things, right? Deuteronomy chapter 8, four times, remember, 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 remember. When Jesus says, do this in remembrance of me, this is not just remember this like you're remembering it on your math test. This is about embodying the felt sense of what you smelled, what you heard, what you tasted, what you touched, in order for it to shape your very body so that you can have a remembered future that is one of durable hope.
Which would also mean then that we don't have to have as much fear of the future, because we have a deeper sense of hope and faith that what we need is, we're going to be met with what we need in any future sufferings, right? We don't have to be so afraid, because
right,
we know we will be met.
Right. I mean, we don't, exactly, because that's actually what's now in our brain.
Yes, exactly. That's what we know deep in the cells of our bodies.
It's what I imagine. Mm-hmm. It's what I think about. It's what I see in my visual cortex when I'm imagining my future.
Yeah. Wow. So we really are then, now we're being formed. Now we're seeing the process by which this durable hope is actually formed in us.
Totally.
Just psychologically, but physiologically in, in the ruts and grooves of our brain and the cells of our bodies.
Right. So I have a question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because we can, you know, we can talk about this from a neuroscience standpoint. But again, as I've remarked several times, I love the intention and attention to formation that the Transforming Center focuses on. And I think I would love to hear, like, I mean, you know, I've said some of this about neuroplastic change. I'm wondering, in the work that you do, how do you see this showing up? And especially for leaders, helping leaders imagine how are, you know, what's the role that they play in mediating, if you will, people's memories, mediating people's experiences as you're training leaders. I'm just wondering how this has application for that.
Well, I think the first thing you and I would both say is that you have to experience it before you can give it away. I mean, you've already said that. And so part of what happens, you know, in our setting would be that leaders experience a different quality of presence with others than they've perhaps experienced anywhere else. And let me just, I want to name for you one moment in the communities that illustrates this. So we practice group spiritual direction as our way of being together in small groups. And so even though we're a large community, pretty like 100 people in the community, but everybody has a small group they're a part of that's usually five people. And group spiritual direction has a structure and a rhythm, and it has to do with, you know, silence and then listening to the person who's presenting their experience and then silence again and then companioning. But when we begin, we purposely don't let people, the first two or three times that they meet, we don't let them respond to each other with words. Because we don't trust them, honestly. You know, we don't trust them not to do all the human things that they do. Fixing, problem solving, making themselves feel better somehow, you know, trying to relieve their own discomfort in the face of this person's pain or difficulty or suffering. So for the first two or three times that they meet, maybe it's at two, the person who is presenting their experience presents, and then once we define what the silence means, that the silence is not, you know, walking away, the silence is actually reverence for your experience. We don't want to put our own words over your experience. We just want to sit with you and be with you and also hold you in God's presence. So we define what the silence is, because silence can be frightening depending on how we've experienced that in our families of origin and things like that. So we do bring definition to what the silence is. And so we send them out into their first experience where they're sharing deeply, but they're not responding to each other verbally. So we encourage people to give that person eye contact, to maybe lean in, tears, there's tears, just, you know, let them be there. But you're giving the person, as you've said, your presence, not your words. And at first people are just like kind of wigged out. Like, really? Like, we're used to being in these small groups where everybody has a discussion and they try to fix each other, and it's kind of therapeutic in that way. And so at first they're very put off, you know, and we help them to pay attention to their discomfort too. When they're not being allowed to say anything, what's going on? Well, I was really uncomfortable. I usually want to fix somebody at that point. I want to be the silver bullet for their life. I'm a pastor, and so I've been trained to help people, you know? But you told us we couldn't, and so I didn't, and I had to just sit there in my discomfort. But then when people come back and we debrief that experience, they say it's the most intimate experience they've had in small group. And it was the presence. It was the presence that was conveyed without the words that can so often do damage, because we don't know how to use our words very well with each other. And so that's an experience that many leaders and pastors haven't had yet. And then once they've had it, then they can begin to understand its power. Because before you've had that experience, you think, well, I must not be doing very much as a leader. If somebody's sharing their pain with me and they're suffering and I'm not giving advice and I'm not helping them and I'm not giving them a book to read and, you know, I must not be doing anything. And so there's almost a reworking of our ideas of what it means to be with each other in these moments. And then, so that's on the one side. On the other side, the person who is sharing or presenting actually reported feeling safer because they knew that they could share what they had to share and they weren't risking somebody coming in and doing all that fixing and problem solving and pontificating and or even that horrible statement, I know just how you feel. I mean, even that, we've been taught how to say stuff like that. Are you kidding me? Like, you don't know how I feel. Stop it. You know, it's a violation for you to say, I know just how you feel. I don't know if you can know that, you know? So we discipline all of that. And then people say, I felt much more free to share because I knew that my story would be reverenced and held, but that I wasn't opening myself up to the kind of violating that oftentimes happens in typical small group environments.
Well, and I can imagine that. I mean, how often do any of us have the opportunity to speak to a group of listeners for whom that is their only task?
Yeah. Just to be present.
For us. I mean, when's the last time we had that much attention? So often our words in response come as a way for me to manage my own anxiety.
That's right.
With what I've just heard that's getting, you know, that's getting kind of like evoked because of the things that I've heard in that person's story. And it is this, I'm just imagining being in that room and the power of the, not just the attunement of one person, but the collective attunement of a group of people and a single person having the experience of being heard and seen and allowing that speaker to take in the attunement. I can imagine that that would be transformational.
Yeah. Well, friends, we want to take a break from our conversation and talk a little bit about Transforming Community 20, which is coming up in April. The first retreat of TC20 is coming up in April. And we've had a huge theme running through this season about the importance of community for real transformation, and particularly as it has to do with a community that's able to be present with suffering and with our suffering without trying to fix us, without trying to problem solve, without trying to tell us what to do with our suffering, but to just be a witness to our suffering. And this is something that the transforming community is particularly good at. In the way that we structure our conversations, we make sure that we are putting an emphasis on being present to one another in whatever it is that we're going through versus fixing and problem solving and telling each other what to do. And so if this is the kind of community that you as a leader know that you need, if you need someplace to go outside of your leadership context to be with people that you can journey with just as a soul in God's presence, Transforming Community is for you. And so in April, we're beginning the next Transforming Community, and we won't be starting another one until 2026. And so if you know you need this kind of a community to be healthy and whole and to keep moving on your spiritual journey, we invite you to discern and to consider Transforming Community 20. If you have any inkling at all to apply, then use the code PODCAST20 and receive $50 off your application fee. So we'll be watching for you, and we're also here standing ready to help you discern whether this opportunity is the right thing for you at this time. So it's interesting to me, Kurt, this is one of the things that I'm more aware of now than maybe I've ever been, and that is that you and I are both creating these very similar group experiences, coming at it from slightly different angles. And I really appreciate that. I don't know, I just have a sense of appreciation for the way in which God has put this on both of our hearts, but even though we're coming at it in different ways, we're using different words to describe the same kind of experience. It's what your confessional communities are, what we're trying to do, you know, in the group experience of the Transforming Center. And that, I don't know, that means something to me right now you know.
Yeah. Well, I think, I don't know about you, I look around, it seems like there are many places where the Spirit is at work, raising up communities of folks who are doing things that are like unto this, that to me sound like responses to kind of the cacophony and the chaos of our age and
the isolation. I mean, even though we're busier and more stimulated than ever, we're also more isolated than ever in terms of the true human experience and feeling companioned in that, in that place.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think one thing to say about, you know, how we've arrived at this place where we are talking about these things in the way that we are says something about not just you know, you or me or others who are doing this, it says something about where we have journeyed in, you know, the last however many years, decades, centuries. And it's also to say that, like, confessional communities, for example, you know, what we're developing, it's not to say that this is, like, the way to do it. We're saying this is a way to move toward this sense of being more deeply known in an embodied way. And there are, we do this in our practice. I also have a nonprofit that makes it available for people who are just interested in doing this in lay-led circumstances. One of the most common questions that I get is, where do I find this group? Mm-hmm. And my response is, it is not a group that you will probably find. It is a group that you will it is a group that you will create.
Yes, I agree.
Mm-hmm. It's a group that you will create.
So, Kurt, I wanted to just say that I appreciated what you shared in your book about your own story. And actually, in Chapter 6, you tell your own personal story about a part of you. You refer back to the internal family systems and parts therapy, and you describe a part of yourself that believes that he is unwantable. And you characterized it as being primal, an amalgamation of your own temperament, your parents' unhealed wounds that they passed on to you epigenetically. And I really want you to talk about epigenetics for a minute. I was so glad to see you bring that word into here because I think it's so important. And then the attachment patterns that you formed with them. Mm-hmm. When I read that, I thought probably all of us could say that. You know, that who we are and what we're dealing with is an amalgamation of all those things. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciated you naming it that way. So, first of all, please define epigenetics, because I don't know if everyone knows what that word means. And I think it's really, really important. Okay. And then how your own journey has been impacted by the very truths that we've been talking about here. In other words, just put a little flesh on these conceptual bones from your own story, if you would.
Yeah, the backdrop on epigenetics is, I mean, our listeners are probably familiar. When we use the word genetics, we're talking about genes and chromosomes and how they play a role in shaping our lives, everything from eye color to height to personality types and so forth. They play a role in that. Some of the things that we experience are more straightforwardly shaped by genetic influence. Most of the genetic influence for most of who we are, neuropsychiatrically, temperamentally, and so forth, is much more nuanced, much more vague, and not nearly as clear in terms of what we actually know from a neuroscience standpoint. But we do know this. There is an influence, a downstream influence, that generations have on the generations that follow. The word genetics is about those genes that we have, and then we have this word epigenetics. It is the word that means above, on top of, or beforehand, that which precedes those gene expressions. And what we mean by that is that an example would be, of course, we understand that my parents give me the eye color that I have. Fine. What we often wouldn't imagine is that my parents also have behaviorally the capacity to affect the expression of genes within me that then have something to do with the degree to which I experience anxiety, for example. So, for example, there are many, many genes in your chromosomes whose main job is to turn off and on other genes. And some of those genes are primed to turn on genes that would make us more easily anxiety prone, for example. So I may be somebody who's really anxious. And if I have a child, my child may be more prone to be easily anxious as well. However, if I go to therapy and I actually do work on my story and I become less anxious, I have the capacity to turn off my genes that make me anxious, and then I pass genes on to my child in which the gene is turned off. And so I have the capacity for affecting downstream my child's experience and expression of anxiety, for example. But the opposite can be just as true. And so when we read in Genesis and Exodus that God's judgment passes to the third and the fourth generation, we see that what's happening is built into the creation is the neurobiology of epigenetics. That's what we're talking about. The beautiful thing about this is that when we are doing work in a community in which our suffering is seen and my anxiety is held, I love that notion that you brought up a while back about having a community that can hold us, not just listen, but hold us. It gives our genes an opportunity to turn on or off in different ways. This is crucial when it comes to parenting. For instance, we tell parents that the single most important thing you can do for your child to make it more likely for them to have a secure attachment is to make sure that you are making sense of your own story. It's the most powerful thing that you can do. Because what you were doing is giving your child an experience of a different you than what you had with your parents. I was born and reared in Eastern Ohio, and my parents were in their mid-40s when I was born. I had three older brothers, 18 years, 16 years, 11 years of age when I was born. And I came into a family in which I learned later, I came into a family in which when my mom became pregnant, it was generally considered not a really cool thing. You've already had your three sons. Now you're 44. What are you going to do? Everybody's worried, as one might expect. Because if you're 44 and you're pregnant in 1962, this is not something that people are excited about. It's something that people are worried about. In addition, I was born into a family in which my parents, who were both God-fearers, loved each other, loved their sons as well as they could, churchgoers, faithful people, also came from backgrounds that were not that easy. My mother, having come from a background where she lost her own mother at age 3 to an ectopic pregnancy, and then had an older, she became a functional orphan because her father couldn't really take care of her and or her siblings. Her oldest brother took his own life. His son took his own life. She grew up basically waiting for the other shoe to drop. My father grew up in a family, born and raised on a farm, people who loved him, but who probably did not see his intelligence for what it was. He had a younger sister eventually who went to college, but he was somebody who never really was encouraged to do that. His parents were not terrible people. They were lovely people. They were farmers. They were doing what they could do to do well in the world. But my father also was a man, as I said earlier. He was a man for whom deeply affectionate, deeply caring about justice, deeply caring about justice for the poor and the underserved, especially in our community, African-American community, in our community, deeply concerned. But you didn't want to cross him. Because when he got angry, you just didn't really want to be in the room. At least this is the story that I'm growing up with. So what became the case for me, I come into a family where I get this kind of an upstream story coming to me of a mother who's anxious and a father who's deeply affectionate and loving, but has not a lot of tools in his box for intimate conversation, for curiosity. And one of the things that I learned how to work really hard to not make sure, to make sure nobody gets angry. And I learned really hard how to make sure nobody gets anxious. And, you know, if you're smart enough and so forth and you do well in school, you know, a lot of these things come together. But what you don't know at the same time that I didn't really discover until much, much later in life is that you came into a world in which your presence, before it was anything else, was anxiety provoking. I was making people anxious. And as a source of anxiety, that anxiety gets passed on to you. And then you find yourself navigating the anxiety that you're swimming in. And you don't really know until I grew up, the narrative, the sense I'm going to make out of what I'm sensing is that I'm not really wanted. I wasn't really wanted. Now, if you were to ask my parents, did you want Kurt? They, of course, would tell you. If they were here, they would say, well, we were like a little worried, but of course we would want him. Except for the parts of them that didn't. Because there's no question. If I'd been my dad, I wouldn't have wanted my wife to be pregnant. But what I did with that was to internalize that. And there is a part of me to this day that walks around believing not only that I'm not wanted, but that I'm not wantable. And you don't really know that you're walking around with that part until that part suddenly walks into the room and grabs the talking stick. And you find yourself feeling embarrassed at the slightest things. You find yourself being apologetic for all kinds of things that aren't your fault. You find yourself being afraid that other people are going to be angry with you. You find all kinds of things to do because the assumption is, I'm not wantable. This is why these things are happening. Whatever it is that's going on. And you burn a lot of energy walking around with the felt sense that you're not wantable. And it's not until I'm able to be in a confessional, in a community of people who create the space whereby which this part can actually start to show up, that I can even name that. And once that part is named, then I have to go about doing the work of being hospitable to him. Because, like, I don't like that part of me. I don't. It doesn't feel good. I don't want him around. I don't want him in the room. I don't want him within a country mile of me. I'd much rather kill him. I want him to be out. Right? Richard Schwartz would have talked about the notion of a scapegoat, the part of us that we just got to get rid of. This would be the part of me, because it's too burdensome for me to have to, like, carry around and contain. And I would have to say that you come to a point where you discover, oh my gosh, the amount of collective grief that I carry in that part, that not only represents my grief, but also represents the grief of the other people that I was trying to regulate over the course of 4, 5, 6 decades. It's only when I encounter others who invite that part of me into the room with fear and trepidation, I might add, that I can begin to do the work of loving that part instead of condemning it, which is also, you know, as we said, the suffering that we, you know, that we foist on ourselves. I mean, as soon as I would start to become aware of this part, I would just want to condemn it. You know, I wasn't kind to it. I just want to condemn it. It's bad enough that I have it, but I'm just going to make him pay even more by condemning him along the way. It's been in the presence, though, of people who have loved me well, that journey has been able to be different, although not perfectly resolved yet.
Well, thank you for bringing that part to us, yeah, to this conversation.
Yeah, thank you for asking. Yeah.
Yeah. And it occurs to me that it's at this particular moment where how we are with each other is so significant.
Mm. Mm.
Because I could imagine that in some typical groups, somebody might want to say, well, you know, might want to actually almost dismiss your experience or dismiss that part by saying, well, of course you're wantable, you know, and in sort of a superficial way address the part,
right,
that you're allowing to show up here versus being present to the part and,
yeah,
being curious and showing loving kindness. And I think the community has a choice right there in terms of how we're going to be together. And I think that's the part we don't know how to do very well.
Yeah. Well, you know,
in typical, I mean, groups.
Yeah. I mean, we keep going back to this moment. I mean, in that conversation that you and I had, I still, with a poignant memory, I still remember the calculation. Am I going to tell her this or not?
Mm-hmm.
It's the moment where I'm fighting to keep the unwantable part of me out of the room. You know, there's the risk of what happens when Ruth hears this part of me. Again, kind of going back through the things that we've talked about, for that part to come into the room and to not be scapegoated gives it a completely different experience from what it has been getting at my own hand. And
yeah,
to come into a place that's not anxious and into a place filled with loving kindness, I mean, that's the essence of the gospel. And we are all, I mean, we're all so anxious. I mean, one of the things that my colleague Courtney Morrison and I, who conduct these groups, these confessional communities, one of the things has been to learn that we can wait for the Spirit to do the work in the room. We can wait. We don't have to talk all the time.
Yes.
We can just say, you know, one of our favorite phrases when someone says something and the temptation is to fix or make an assessment or an analysis or whatever, one of our favorite phrases is, I would love for you to say more about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an invitation. Like, well, I've just said something that I'm not very proud of, and now you're asking for more of that. Which means somebody's being hospitable. Mm-hmm. They're not just sitting waiting. They're inviting me to say more about this. And it is in that space that the part of us that suffers literally has a neurophysiologic experience that is often quite different from what we're used to having, certainly when we're sitting with the isolation of it in our own mind privately, let alone when we're with others with whom perhaps historically, whether it's our family of origin or a church or wherever, where we've felt the condemnation instead.
Yeah, and you know, a few minutes ago you were using the word model, you know, to talk about how we do groups, but I've never used that word because it doesn't resonate with me. But what does resonate with me, and it's very congruent with what you just said, is to have some sort of a structure that enables you to be and to do what you really most want to be and to do, you know? Mm-hmm. And in the case that you just mentioned, where creating space to let the Holy Spirit be the one who is the one doing the work. That is precisely the structure that corresponds to a deep desire, and that is that we do want the Spirit to be in the room, right?
Yeah, totally.
And the structure enables that to happen. If you don't have the structure, our human cells are going to rush in and do the human thing. But a different kind of structure, whether it's the structure that you have in place for your confessional community or whether it's the group spiritual direction structure that we hold, the structure is to enable you to be with each other in the way you most deeply want to be together, you know, beyond all the human, you know, impulses that we have, you know, to get in there and do other things. You know, the structure actually helps us to leave the space open for the work that only God can do. So I love the way that you just worded that we don't always have to talk. We don't always have to rush in. In fact, that's part of what makes groups unsafe is when human beings think they are going to be the ones to act upon each other versus leaving some space and holding some space for the Spirit to do work. Well, thank you so much for, you know, just giving us a window into your own story. And I'll also say that the conversation that you keep referencing, you know, what it was like for you to have a part that was welcomed with loving kindness. And I truly wasn't anxious. What you shared with me just felt beautiful and honest. And so that's what you felt. And on my side, my sense of it was, oh, we've just moved into a real relationship, you know, into a real relationship between real people versus Kurt coming in and just being our hired gun speaker. Do you know what I mean? So that's what I remember about it was that was the beginning of a real relationship versus just the transactional speaker thing that was going on. And it's also even part of why even now I thought I know Kurt and I can have a full conversation and season on these things because we've been there. We know how to we know how to be there with each other. We can do this. And I think that conversation actually is part of what brought this moment out is because it's just a building on a moment that we already had, you know,
right on.
That was very real. Well, this has been very, very rich, and I'm hoping that for our listeners, that last piece where you gave us one really specific and concrete example of a part and how life together in community with others can begin to shift how that part is functioning within your internal family that are all living together inside yourself. Yeah. It's just inspiring that those are choices. That, you know, you made a choice, and it shifted something, and we can all make choices like that when we sense that someone is safe and that it's a relationship that can hold it. We can all make the risky choices sometimes to do that thing that will create space for God to form real hope in us, and I hope that we will.
Yeah, and I think it's important to say that those risky choices are necessary. Suffering does not take care of itself. It does not take care of itself. It was a risky choice for God to make us.
Yeah.
It was a risky choice for Jesus to show up. And at the same time, God continues to be supremely confident that he's never going to run out of options, no matter how risky the choices are.
Yeah. Yes. Amen. Well, Kirk, this has been a really rich conversation, and I especially appreciated your transparency around your own story. And we, as always, we want to add some work to this one. And I think because we've seen this theme of the confessional community, or even we've talked about it as group spiritual direction, the way that we practice it, but people might be thinking, what is that? How do I do that? You said that we are probably not going to find it. We're going to have to create it. So we want to go over to Patreon and talk about the work, and the work being this time, how can I perhaps participate and cooperate with God in creating the kind of community where these kinds of things can be shared and where we can actually build perseverance towards this durable hope. So I am most grateful to you for our time together on these themes. And I invite all of us to go over to Patreon now, Patreon.com/Transforming Center, or find our link in the show notes, and we'll allow Kurt to give a little bit of really concrete guidance about how we might be able to create these communities for ourselves. Thanks so much, Kurt, for all that you shared.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.